Welcome to session 608, Labor Records and So Much More, New Directions in Acquisition, Access, and Outreach for Labor Collections. My name is Jordan Patty, and I'm the Processing Archivist and Interim Head of Special Collections at George Mason University Libraries. Before I introduce the speakers this morning, I would like to say a few words about this session. These presentations today will explain how collections that are referred broadly to as labor records cross many subject areas. The records are not just about union administration, grievance files, and voting issues. The records that the presenters will discuss today cover civil rights, political movements, and most importantly, the stories of people who have been left out of the official historical narrative. The presenters will also touch on an important aspect of archives work, appraisal. As both Frank Bowles and Mark Green discuss in separate articles in the most recent issue of the American Archivist, appraisal continues to play a vital role in many aspects of archives work, including acquisition, access, and outreach. The session topic is ideal since this is the 25th anniversary of the founding of the Labor Archives Roundtable. The hard work completed by the membership of the Labor Archives Roundtable over the past several decades is well represented in the newly published How to Keep Union Records. This session serves as an excellent companion to those two milestones. The first speaker this morning is Gail Momgreen. Gail has been processing archivist and associate head for archival collections at the Robert F. Wagner Labor Archives for 20 years. She has surveyed, accessioned, and processed, or supervised the processing of, more than 300 collections of labor records, a total of more than 10,000 linear feet. She has provided reference service for these collections, produced exhibits and publications, and regularly speaks to classes and other user groups about the potential use of labor-related materials. The second speaker is Tracy Drummond. Tracy has been working in the archives profession since 2001, and as the Southern Labor Archivist since July of 2007. Faced with a huge backlog and space issues, she has searched for and implemented methods to make collections available quickly while recovering space for incoming collections, including adapting MPLP and appraisal for the archives. Since beginning work at the Southern Labor Archives in 2007, Tracy has supervised the processing of over 700 linear feet of materials. The third speaker is Laura Starrett. Laura graduated with the Master's of Science in Information Sciences from the University of Tennessee in 2009 and was awarded the Education Scholarship to the 2008 Society of Tennessee Archivists Conference. She completed practicums at the Highlander Center and at the McClung Historical Collection and worked at the McClung Museum at the University of Tennessee as the Images Archivist. She is just about to start a new job at the as Archivist at the Atlanta History Center. The fourth speaker is Nancy Williams. Nancy also graduated with a Master's of Science in Information Sciences from the University of Tennessee in 2009 and was a recipient of the Mary C. Barnes Scholarship and the University of Virginia Rare Book School Scholarship in 2008. She interned at the Highlander Center and completed an accessioning project. Nancy assisted with the development of a file naming system to suit the unique needs of the repository, a database that cross-references condition assessment and accession information, recruited and trained volunteers, and coordinated the project. At completion, over 650 collections were accessioned and appraised using an innovative combination of digital and traditional tools. Nancy is currently the collection development librarian at South College in Knoxville. She's been doing that for a year now. And with that, Gail's going to speak now.
Thanks, Jordan. Hello, everybody. I'm shorter. A few weeks ago, I made a big decision in my life. I decided to retire after 20 years of work at the Wagner Labor Archives and move on to some other special projects. So this presentation naturally evolved into a kind of retrospective, an attempt to sum up one archivist's experience of one labor archive through a period of transformative change. Certainly the last 20 years have seen profound changes in the labor movement, in the global economy, and in the collective experience of working people everywhere. At the same time, we labor archivists have seen dramatic, even revolutionary changes on our own turf, in our collecting practices, in our tools for managing, describing, and providing access to collections, in research use, and in the kinds of constituencies we serve. And the pace of change hasn't exactly been constant. I think most of us could agree that we've seen some pretty serious speed up in the last few years. The Wagner Labor Archives at NYU has been fortunate as we face these new challenges. We've enjoyed a relatively high level of support from NYU, from the labor movement itself, and from other public and private funders. Lately, our expansion and robust financing owes a great deal to the effort of our current director, Mike Nash, who some of you saw earlier in the week. As you see, the Tamamit Library and Wagner Archives is a two-part institution. One part, Tamamit, is venerable. The other, the Wagner, is fairly new. One is devoted to the political history of the American left, and the other to labor records, both with an emphasis on the New York metropolitan area, loosely defined. They cohabit very comfortably, and needless to say, the political and labor collections overlap and intersect at many points. The Tamamit originated as the library of the Rand School of Social Science, founded in 1906 and owned and managed by the Socialist Party. For many years, the school occupied its own building on 15th Street. There's the old building. In Manhattan, and functioned as a combination of a school for workers and a kind of community center for political activists. It had a bookstore, a cafeteria, an auditorium, meeting rooms, and so on. When the school fell on hard times, the library was taken over by and took on the name of Camp Tamamit, the party's flourishing summer camp in the Poconos. Finally, a deal was made to transfer the collections to NYU, and after the new library building opened in the early 1970s, the Tamamit came to rest in its current location on the 10th floor of NYU's Bopes Library. The Robert F. Wagner Labor Archives was founded in the late 70s as a joint effort by Tamamit, the New York City Central Labor Council, and others who very much wanted there to be an archive located in the city that would collect labor records from New York. As time went on, the collections expanded to be national in scope, and we've worked out some pretty amicable divisions of jurisdiction with our friendly colleagues at Cornell, Wayne State, the Meany Center, and so on. The initiators had a great stroke of luck early on when they hired Deborah Bernhard, a young labor archivist and political activist from the wilds of Michigan by way of Ohio, who was a tireless collection builder. She had an uncanny ability to extract labor records and sometimes even money from union officials, some of whom had a deep distrust of universities in general and NYU in particular, and many of whom were far from comfortable with the idea of opening their union files to general scrutiny. Crucially for the future strength of the Wagner Archives, Deborah was careful to replicate the Tamamit's staunchly ecumenical collecting policy. Thus, the records of organizations and individuals, including rivals, dissidents, factions, and rank-and-file groups, who might well be at each other's throats in the union halls or on the streets, have come together under one roof in conditions of open and equal access. Deborah began by leading a massive labor records survey. And this is one of the original survey forms in Deborah's handwriting. These forms would be done in the field and brought back to the library where they'd be typed up and expanded. Oral history interviews were often done also to fill in gaps in the record. And because an intensive couple of hours of recorded reminiscing was a good way of building trust and a bond with the archives. So by the time of Deborah's untimely death in 2001, our core group of labor collections was in place, and we're still using some of those old surveys to track down collections and bring them in. Meanwhile, we brought in far more than just union records. We get papers of labor lawyers, journalists, arbitrators, labor historians. We just got the papers of Howard Zinn, for example, and vast quantities of audiovisual and graphic material, artifacts, and a host of obscure labor publications. The early collecting building didn't leave all that much time for processing and description. Staff tended to divide their time between the field and the reference desk. When I first came to work at the Wagner Archives in 1989, much of our cataloging was still on typed 3x5 cards. Here's one of those cabinets that still resides in our reading room, and we even look in them every once in a while. Accession files were sketchy, to put it mildly, and were kept in a file cabinet next to the director's desk. There was a small shelf of archival guides and inventories and little standardization of archival description. There were two or three computer terminals used mostly by the librarians. Archivists generally used computers for word processing inventories or writing letters. We still wrote a lot of letters in those days. There was no thought of putting archival guides or anything else about the archives online beyond a smattering of MARC records. On the reference desk, we had to rely heavily on collection information stored in our heads. Many collections had no recorded location information. In fact, some of those 3x5 cards still had location information from the old building in 15th Street. It was a challenge, but also kind of fun. We saw ourselves as walking repositories of arcane information. But it was dodgy for the researchers, who might fare better or worse depending on who happened to be on the reference desk when they came in. And God help you if your key archivist happened to be out sick. Our users of labor collections were a rather small, specialized group, mostly academics, dissertation writers, and union staff, who visited the archives in person to investigate the traditional themes of labor studies, individual union histories, collective bargaining, aspects of labor law, and so on. They tended to learn about the archives from each other through word of mouth or by reading each other's footnotes, or they might happen to meet a member of the archives staff at a labor gathering or academic conference. All of this changed very fast in the 90s. Computers proliferated, driven at first by people's desire to use email, and then we began to see the advantage of standardizing our finding aids. We developed a Word template, we hired people to do EAD markup, and we began to manage the collections with an Access database. By the end of the decade, we had a minimally respectable website and a couple of hundred finding aids posted, but no means of searching them as a group. The pace picked up very quickly after that, and when the Archivist Toolkit came along, we were pretty ready for it. We now have close to 1,000 finding aids online and easily searchable as a group. The immediate effect of all these improvements was a huge surge in use of the collections, and some patterns began to emerge. I noticed early on that relatively few of our new researchers were using labor collections to study what would be called straight labor history. Many more were looking at what could be called the political dimension of labor. Labor and the old and new left, especially communism and anti-communism, labor and foreign policy, gender and race issues in unions, and in the workplace. Clearly, this was a direct outgrowth of the political ferment of the 60s and 70s, and the reverberations are still felt today. For example, my guess is that the single most popular topic of study over the last 20 years at the archives, from high school students on up, has been Ocean Hill-Brownsville and the New York teachers' strike of 1968. Big collection of ours, the United Federation of Teachers. It's almost always approached as a problem in race relations and not so much as a chapter in labor history. Labor and politics are fellow travelers at Tamiment. Just a few examples. Here's an NMU pamphlet honoring their members who fought in the Spanish Civil War, which is a very good theme to follow up at Tamiment, since we're also the archive of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, one of our very big and popular collections. Two book covers dealing with issues of gender and sexuality. Both the two of the authors, Jane Latour and Miriam Frank, worked at the Wagner Archives for a number of years, and both donated all their interviews and all their research materials to our collections. So labor and politics are our traditional stock and trade. But lately, and there's no question about it, we're seeing a lot more of researchers who aren't particularly interested in labor or in the labor movement as such. They come to us through Google searches, of course, but also because we're beginning to learn how to market ourselves in different ways. By the way, there's a side benefit, and that's that we have a much higher profile within the university community now. Where we used to see mostly history classes or labor studies classes from outside NYU, we now host classes in English, art history, Spanish, media studies, journalism, you name it. Here are just a few examples of non-labor dimensions or non-labor uses of our labor collections. As in the labor movement today, our strength is heavily in service industries and public employees. We have a lot of AFSCME collections. Tracking research use, we see that public employee collections are a rich source for urban history and politics in general. Elections, mayoral administrations, inner workings of city agencies, urban health care, including AIDS issues, changing trends in education and child care, that kind of thing. Art and art history. More and more our patrons are studying our graphic collections, posters, illustrations, and especially cartoons and comic books as art. And they're taking more of an interest in the artists themselves. This is a labor poster by Bernard Seaman, relatively little-known New York labor artist, but a good one. Music. We have sheet music, songbooks, files on performers, performance history, folk, classical, opera, cabaret. We have the relevant unions. In fact, we have collections covering all the major entertainment unions in New York City. Theater and theater history. With the Actors' Equity Collection came more than 10,000 theatrical programs dating back to the beginning of the 20th century. The actors use them to document their careers so they can qualify for benefits when they retire. We get a lot of those calls. But they're also used to study the history of individual theaters and theatrical production, and we get an increasing number of inquiries from playwrights, novelists, costume designers, scenic designers, and so on, interested in our labor collections in general. Somebody calls and says, we're doing a production of Waiting for Lefty. What kind of posters should we have hanging on the wall, and can we reproduce them from your collection? Radio and television history, a very, very hot area right now. And good news for us, since our biggest labor project currently underway is processing the records of AFTRA, the TV and radio union. Sports history. When we took in the papers of Marvin Miller, the first and mightiest executive director of the Major League Baseball Players Association, a whole new universe of researchers showed up, including quite a few from Japan. And these people were interested in baseball. They were not interested in labor. Architecture and the built environment. In our building trades collections, we have maps, street plans, blueprints, a photographic record of the construction of the Chrysler Building and the Empire State Building, all kinds of urban planning material, and even some World Trade Center files that date from before 9/11. This is urban history for sure. Here's a typical list of luncheon speakers out of one of our document collections. I don't know if you can see it. It's urban history. It starts with Mayor Lindsay and so on. And who knew that Spiro Agnew spoke at the New York Building Trades Congress the day before he resigned as vice president? Little nuggets of celebrity history are also embedded in all these collections. And speaking of buildings, our hotel union records are mostly arranged in groups by individual hotel, club, or restaurant. So you can trace the history of the Waldorf Astoria or any hotel and the composition of its workforce right through from the 1920s. The hotel and restaurant workforce was very ethnically diverse from early on, and men and women worked in close proximity. Inter-ethnic and gender tensions ran high. And in those very colorful grievance files, you're reminded constantly that these interactions took place in an environment where sharp objects were a constant presence. There's a lot of violence in the grievance files of the hotel workers. Ethnic and immigration history, of course. How can New York history not be the history of immigrants? The transport workers' records and the papers of their longtime president, Mike Quill, have a wealth of information on both Irish-American and Irish history. Quill's correspondence files are full of letters from Ireland, filling him in on the political situation there, begging money for Catholic charities, telling stories of hard times, and inquiring about whether he could help the writers get work if they managed to get over to New York. He usually did help if he possibly could. And here's Quill again campaigning for the city council and two other immigrant communities. When it came to documenting the history of Asian American working people in New York, one of our newer projects, we found that union records really weren't good enough. It just wasn't enough. It wasn't yielding enough. So we've turned in our collecting strategy much more to community organizations, organizations that offered education, legal aid, and health care aid to newly arrived immigrants and the community in general. So we're having a very different array of records in the Asian collections. It's no surprise that New York Labor and Left collections are going to be rich in Jewish history and culture. The biggest single labor collection we have is the records of the Jewish Labor Committee, an umbrella group of Jewish-led unions founded in the mid-30s to coordinate anti-Nazi activity and offer aid to refugees and later to Holocaust survivors. These are two items from the collection, one from Poland and one from New York, both from the 1930s. This is, of course, a major resource in Holocaust history, and it's a huge collection. It was about 1,000 feet when we first brought it in. The JLC records and other Jewish and Judaica-oriented collections probably bring in the largest single group of researchers who are not doing labor studies as such. And in a related topic, anti-Semitism, racism, and prejudice. Most unions don't keep the hate mail they receive, although they tend to receive it in large quantities. Two that did save it to a certain extent are the transport workers and the United Federation of Teachers. This particular message was written in 1975. It poured in from the time of the teachers' strike and continued. This was an item from 1975. And the theme of "you greedy Jews, you money-hungry Jews," addressed to Albert Shanker, is particularly ironic since Shanker and Victor Gottbaum of AFSCME were at that time working really hard to figure out how the unions might bail out New York from a major fiscal crisis. But there's a lot of this kind of thing in the collections, and it really is a very revealing of the psychology of prejudice and hate and so on. My personal favorites are the letters denouncing Mike Quill, the quintessential Irish-American, as a queer Jewish communist. They exist. These are some novel uses of conventional formats, but we're also changing the very nature of what we collect. We participate in a major pilot project now for archiving websites, in which we're responsible for the sites relating to labor and the left. The sites are harvested at varying intervals, and finding aids are posted for topical groups or collections of sites. Here's one of those finding aids from our website for the collection that is a group of labor websites. In the container list, you see URLs in place of folder titles. When you click on the URL, you go not to the site itself, but to the archived websites, however many have been accumulated, starting with the earliest site collected. Now, projects like this pose challenges, not only technical challenges, but issues of ethics, of privacy, of access, how to make access available to, for how long, to what group of users, and all the rest of it. And we've noticed that a number of unions have sections on their websites that are for members only. Actors Equity does this, other unions do this, and we're not harvesting those sections. So we're missing things. There's duplication of links. The university is beginning to complain about server space. There's a whole new array of issues that comes about when we start dabbling in these new types of projects. We've also been approached about archiving email accounts. And here again, privacy, storage, and access questions are going to loom very large. We're now on Facebook and Twitter. Selections from our collections are displayed via Flickr and ArtStore. We participate in an NYU Special Collections blog, but we haven't yet been out there long enough or in an organized enough way to tell how this new presence will affect our day-to-day practice. as workers, and yes, we archivists are workers too, we need to guard against being expected to maintain all these new technologies as a kind of add-on to our current jobs, which is what tends to happen now. We haven't yet really integrated this work into our concept of what the work of the archive really is. As archivists, we still wield a degree of power over the creation of the historical record. We control access to a considerable degree. We decide how to publicize what we have. In this age of information overload, a tip or a nudge from an archivist, either in person or online, can still determine when or whether a particular resource is used. But at the same time, we find ourselves in the grip of forces we really can't control: budget constraints, legal constraints, space issues, the serendipity of donors' decisions, wacky as they sometimes are, institutional politics, the shifting agendas and requirements of our funding agencies, and then there's that rising level of impatience coming at us from patrons who just don't understand why they can't get everything they want from us online. In the dark of night, we wonder, maybe one day everything will be online, and what will our role as archivists be then? What will the university itself look like 20 years on, never mind the archives? Could the archives go the way of the bookstore? Ironically, our very successes of the past decade or so, the fact that we get roughly 3,000 patron visits a year, bringing more and more requests for boxes and copies, more classes coming, more public events, plus minding the websites and the social networks and figuring out how to collect and preserve electronic records, leaves us precious little time for long-term planning. Staff meetings tend to focus on putting out today's fires. We're lucky if we can see a few weeks ahead. And there's still so much to do, even of the kind of work we've always done. How can we move beyond a limited vision of labor archives as stripped-down service providers and assure their continuing role as a physical virtual space where professionals and the public can meet to educate each other and consult together about how to best preserve and disseminate the legacy of labor and working class history we all care so passionately about? With all my heart, I wish success to you who will be carrying on that task and that legacy.
Thanks, Gail. Now we're going to hear from Tracy.
Hey, everybody. Good morning. Thanks for coming. I don't have a slideshow. I suspect all of you know what appraisal looks like. And if you don't, then how fortunate are you that you haven't dealt with that at this point in your career? So my presentation today is called Appraisal for Content, Space, and Outreach in the Southern Labor Archives. It's about efforts to integrate appraisal into all of the phases of the work with the collections in the archives. Of all of you who actually works with or has worked with labor records, I'd be curious to see of any kind of form. Nice, okay. And I suspect the rest of you have large collections, even if you don't have necessarily labor records, and that appraisal is also an issue in your repository. So regardless of your collecting area, we all have the goal, the pretty universal goal of managing repository holdings efficiently. So first, a little bit of background on the Southern Labor Archives. We brought in the first collection in 1971, so next year we will be celebrating our 40th year. We collect pretty much from D.C. down to Florida and Georgia over to Louisiana, even though we do have a couple of national and international collections. We're part of Georgia State University Library, which is located in Atlanta, Georgia. And I don't know how many of you have ever visited or know anything about it. It's an urban campus, and we've repurposed a lot of older buildings. So we don't really have an archive space. I mean, we have a library, but we actually have five other collecting areas in addition to Southern Labor Archives. And so we have 5 different locations on campus, not necessarily broken down by what's collected. Of the 5 locations, the Southern Labor Archives is in 4 of those areas, and 3 of those 4 areas, we are the vast majority of material in there. Of approximately 25,000 linear feet of materials total at our archives and special collections, 1/3 of it is labor. So space is an issue. Space is an issue for everybody. If you've got 20 collections, if you've got 200 collections. And we want to continue to grow our collections, and so we have to make decisions about what we're going to be keeping. Over 80% of our collection is labor union records. We do have personal papers of labor organizers and other people in the labor movement. And we also have the records of organizations that are labor-related or progressive. But what I'm talking about today really mainly applies to the labor union records that we have. Just a little bit about labor unions, for those of you that might not know, and for those of you that do, I hope you agree. There's no records management training for local or regional offices. And if there is some, it's not often enforced, especially the smaller the local and the further out it is. Record storage and retrieval can become overwhelming considering the amount of paper generated by even a small local. Minutes, financial documents, legal documents, negotiation files, organizing files, grievances and arbitration, travel logs, correspondence for the office or for different officers, mail-outs, local newsletters, flyers, committee files, strike files, seniority files, membership lists and cards, benefits information, application forms, apprenticeship program files, et cetera. I've left a lot of them out. But even at the local level, you can see how quickly it can build up. Some unions at the national or international level will tell unions how long to keep certain items that they have to have to protect themselves legally, but not when or how to take care of anything else that's created in that office. Not only that, they really don't have any follow-up. So when the period of time is over for the things that they do give them guidelines for, there's no guarantee that any of that stuff is actually taken care of or shredded on time or anything like that. So given the other responsibilities and minimal office staffing in labor union offices, they become easily overwhelmed, and that leads to 2 things. Either a crippling amount of material that they feel like is just that they're under and they can't do anything and they call you needing you to come get all of it at once, or they call a shredder and back it up to the back door and get everything out of there that way. So our predicament, very simply, is that we often end up working with a ton of records and we can't keep everything even if we wanted to. So appraisal starts for us even before the records come into the archives. When we're able to, we'll go visit locals. Sometimes I've even been able to travel out of state, which is nice, to go and talk to the union and talk to them about what we take and what we do. We provide all potential donors, no matter where they are, with guidelines for unions considering donating their collections. We started out with very humble guidelines, but thanks to the good folks at the Ruther Library, we were able to steal a great form that they have and modify it for our needs locally and use that. So it covers everything from the deed of gift to tax deductions to how to box and ship the records to us. But the most important thing in there is it includes a list of record types that we want and a list of record types that we do not. These include routine financial documents, routine office management records, information available elsewhere, and loose papers or documents that have not been folded and labeled. Additionally, the guidelines make clear that we will not provide active records management. If a union needs to keep something for a particular period of time, it should not be sent to the archives. Instead of being met with opposition, though, which I expected this to happen more and more, they're just so relieved when we say we have guidelines and that we're there to help them get their records and bring them back to the archives. It also opens the conversation about what happens to the records when they leave the labor office and go into the archives, which is a bonus, because the unions are always happy to see you come and take stuff off, but they always have questions about what happens to them when they leave here and who uses them and how are they used and will we have access to them, but they don't always know how to ask those questions. I don't know if you labor archivists in here can, you know, agree, but you're in this very special position where you work with scholars and you work with the labor unions, and it's like they've never talked to each other. So it's important to let them know that no matter who is able to see them, that they always have access to their records once they come. And that eases a lot of people's minds when you're in there trying to talk to them about what you will and won't take. If there's enough room to work in their space, we will. We'll always take the opportunity to do that if we can, so that we can handpick. But it's good for them to see you in there. Sometimes it only takes a couple of days. Sometimes it can take months to go in and get things. We can't always do this. But we do provide the guidelines to all donors. And it's especially useful, though, when folks are far away. You can send it to them, and they can use it when they are going through their files and deciding what to send. So they're even doing a little of the appraisal for you before you get the stuff. And granted, not all of them use it. You can send it to them 100 times and talk to them on the phone 50 more times, and they're still going to pack up those office catalogs and 200 copies of that brochure from 1975 and send it. But you know what? I'd rather have it than not have it. I'd rather have to do more work. But a lot of people have been really accommodating, and that's great. And then just in the last 3 years that I've been there, we've probably, because of guidelines, these guidelines have been able to refuse up to 400 linear feet of material that isn't in our archive today, which is great given our space constraints. On-site appraisal is good for donor relations. Like I was just saying, it's a good way to start talking to them. You go in ostensibly to do the on-site appraisal, but then you develop conversations and you start talking to them about their history and you start talking to them about their work and what's been important to them. And an example of this is that we've been working with the union to bring their stuff in since last fall. The first time they came over, and I've seen so much, and I've never seen, everything was crammed into a very small basement, and the guy there, he's been president of that local for 50 years, almost. I think in 2012, it'll be 50 years, and so it's his legacy. It's all his. Everything down there is his, and he was so worried in the beginning about us taking the things away and not keeping everything, but the more we've gone over to work and been responsive with questions they had for us and talked to them, the relationship's grown, and the amount of trust that has developed is amazing. And another great thing to come out of it is just last week I went over there to interview him for an oral history. So he's so pleased and on board with the work that we're doing. He's agreed to an oral history. He's gotten a former vice president to do an oral history. He's going to get him to do one with us, and somebody who was an officer there from like the 40s through the 70s, I think. And not only that, they're going to pay for the transcription. So this has really been a great example of how starting by going over to talk to them about what you will and won't take has turned into a great working relationship. And as a final note, we always encourage them to follow any directives from their union headquarters before letting us take anything. We always provide the caveat. We can't help what happens after that. And so then we appraise again when collections are accessioned and inventoried. Several approaches have been adopted for bringing in records, all ensuring that unwanted records never make it to our shelves. Our goal is not to put anything new in our storage spaces that we will not keep once we're able to process the collection. So if we can perform on-site appraisal, we double-check the content of the boxes and remove anything we do not want as soon as they arrive. And we make the inventory. We're able to look at the collection more closely. Are there duplicates? Did they accidentally pack invoices, for example? And sometimes this takes a little bit of my time and my processing archivist time up front, because normally an inventory is a task that would be relegated to a student. But if we're able to work with the student while we're doing it, they are learning what to look for when doing the inventories. And we have one student now who's just amazing, and she's picking up everything so quickly, and I feel like this will be work that I can eventually give to her. And again, it's worth any time of ours it takes in the beginning just to make sure that things aren't hitting our shelves that we don't want to keep. The inventory phase also allows us to remove books and periodicals. Is that better? I'm asking now. Books and periodicals for deaccessioning or cataloging, and to make sure that each box is packed to capacity so that there are no half-empty boxes taking up valuable shelf space. There's nothing more frustrating than pulling down a 30-box collection and realizing there's only about 20 feet of material there. We appraise again when processing. Our archives, like many modern collections, has a substantial backlog. And like many archives, we've implemented minimum standards guidelines for processing our records. And because of this, we have a twofold approach to appraisal when processing. If we're getting one of the older collections that just so happens not to have an inventory, we'll survey a sampling. We'll pull down boxes and survey a sampling to really see what's there. Because as much as these collections are alike, they can all be incredibly different. So we get a better idea of what's there and identify the materials that we do and do not want to keep. But the minimum standards processing guidelines provide an additional layer of appraisal as well. It includes a list of record types that we do not keep, regardless of the collection. And it's probably not a surprise for you to hear that this list is the same list of things that we provide to our donors initially. Having these guidelines in place increases the speed at which we are both able to appraise and process, regardless of who's doing the work. And a few final thoughts on this. I do understand that appraisal is difficult, and I stress that these are guidelines. But by making firm decisions about information that is less historically rich, perhaps, we won't run the risk of running out of space and having to turn donors away. And that's just the reality of the work that we do. And our guidelines are just that. We assess in each collection individually and make a final decision based on the collection at hand. A recent example of this is that we had a 15-box collection of AFL-CIO Committee on Political Education Southern Region collection. Five of those 15 boxes were boxes just full of unfolded material that had been thrown in off somebody's desk. And typically, the guidelines provide that we may not keep those things, but I looked through and found them to be an amazing collection of field reports, extensive weekly reports from a local or regional officer, and it also provides extensive documentation on local, county, and state politicians and on internal AFL-CIO disputes regarding support for labor-friendly candidates. So it was a gem, and it was an amazing thing to find. And so I know that all of you understand the complexities of this. Guidelines help, but they are not always the final word. I believe vamping is the word that Pat Galloway used earlier when she was getting on to me about this. And so these are just our attempts to manage our collections for space and quality, whether newly accessioned or ready to be processed after 20 years at the archives.
Thank you, Tracy. Now we're going to have a joint presentation to wrap up the session. Laura's going to go first, and then Nancy's going to wrap things up. And then afterwards, we'll have plenty of time for questions. So,
we'll also have candy after our presentation. Okay, so we have anything but business as usual, sessioning the archives at the Highlander Center. Since its founding in, that's a little too loud, I think. Can you all still hear me? Wonderful. Since its founding in 1932, the Highlander Research and Education Center has worked with thousands of individuals and organizations on hundreds of local and regional projects throughout the South. It's also built and maintained connections with activists, popular educators, and researchers around the world. The following presentation is based on a project that Nancy organized as an independent study and that we completed as volunteers, which focused on the special accessioning needs of the Highlander Center. In this presentation, we hope to explain the special accessioning needs and our responses to them. To begin with, we'll start with a short history of the center. The Highlander Research and Education Center, then known as the Highlander Folk School, was created in 1932 by Miles Horton and Don West in Grundy County, Tennessee, on a donated farm just outside of Monteagle. From 1932 until the mid-1940s, Highlander strove to build a progressive labor movement in the South, and supported strikes and organizing drives, and trained workers to take on leadership roles in labor unions. In 1937, Highlander joined the Southern organizing drive of the Congress of Industrial Workers and became an integral part of the labor movement in the region, conducting labor education programs with workers from 11 Southern states. This left the center with a vast collection of the evolution of the labor movement since the 1930s, especially in Appalachia. Highlander still serves as a catalyst for the grassroots organizing and movement building in the South. The collections at the Highlander Center document the activities of an organization at the epicenter of countless social justice and labor movements since the early 1930s. So the Highlander archives are comprised of a number of different information formats. The collections include not only manuscripts, such as Miles Horton's personal papers and handwritten notes of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, but also vinyl records, audio tapes, reel-to-reel films, photographs, and a number of pamphlets, broadsides, and other ephemera. There also includes song sheets, workshop outlines, plays, collections on environmental work. All of these are part of the collection and researchers use regularly. And we haven't even gotten to the issues. The Highlander Center's collections have many issues that we had to take into account when creating an accessioning policy, some common, some unique. The center at one point faced federal raids and a dissolution of the collections. Initially, the collection policy was loosely designed to become more or less a catch-all archives, and not just for labor and civil rights collections, but also as a general Appalachia archives. There were materials that really didn't belong in the collection, there was no record of how things were done before, and there was no plan for prioritizing the processing of collections. In 1959, while the FBI was actually investigating the Highlander Center for what they considered subversive activities, the state of Tennessee took the initiative and locked up the building and confiscated what they found there. And as you see, Miles Horton says, you can put a lock on a door, but you can't lock up an idea. Luckily, many of the collections were either been borrowed or had been shipped off prior to the raid, but this raid led to the school's charter being revoked and the center being closed in 1960. The collections were orphaned for a year, and in 1961, the school relocated to Knoxville, rechartered as the Highlander Research and Education Center, the name that it currently has. It was soon closed again, and this time the property was confiscated and sold at public auction. In 1971, a deal was worked out with the Highlander Center records for 1932 to 1965, and they were given to the State Historical Society of Wisconsin, mainly because the Tennessee State Archives would not put any restrictions in, and the center was still concerned with ongoing investigations by the FBI into the members' work. In 1972, the construction was completed on the center in Newmarket, where the center and its core collection still resides. Now, this instability actually led to unique issues in accessioning the collections. When working on an accessioning policy at the Highlander Archives, we had to take into account the fact that collections were held in multiple repositories. You see, while the Highlander does maintain a core collection at the Harry Lasker Memorial Library in Newmarket, the principal repository for materials outside this core collection is in the Wisconsin State Historical Society in Madison, which, as I mentioned, holds the records from 1932 to 1965. But in addition to these collections, Highlander-related materials also housed at the Appalachian State University in Boone, North Carolina, the Tennessee State Archives in Nashville, East Tennessee Historical Society in Knoxville, the Nashville Public Library, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Now, at this point, there still is no formal policy on what materials go to which repository other than at the discretion of the Highlander librarian, which is something that she will be working on. Some material... writing down. She knows where they should go. She just needs to write them down. some materials do have a basic thing. For instance, Guy and Candy Carawan, who are most notable for their work with Pete Seeger in popularizing the song We Shall Overcome, had already sent their materials to UNC Southern Historical Collections. So materials related to their work will also be sent there. Some materials are sent to the Tennessee State Archives, which actually has now copies of the collection held at Wisconsin. So action materials are still sent to the center to be accessioned, and then they are transferred to one of those. Like many archivists new to an institution, we face the question of what happened before I got here. What happened if the last archivist was hit by a Pontiac? The Highlander Center has the same issues. The project initially focused on accessioning the materials, but we realized that there needs to be a set policy and a record of those policies. Otherwise, really, what was the point? It would just change next year. There were so many idiosyncratic administrative policies, practices, and few, if any, previous administrative records of how the collections were accessioned or processed, where they were transferred to, or why they were kept. We had no idea where anything was. But much of this reporting is being done through the database that Nancy will talk about in a few moments. But one of the administrative policies that was created was our deaccessioning policy. the accessioning policy. In the early days of the Highlander Archives, there was talk of the Highlander Center becoming more or less a catch-all Appalachian archives because it was in the periphery of so many movements across the South. Many considered it a likely repository for materials that didn't have a home elsewhere, and groups and individuals sent material there. Unfortunately, nothing was done on the Highlander Center side, so there was no collection policy at that point. And a lot of materials actually came to Highlander and were either disposed of or just kind of shoved in the corner for later. Later never comes, in case you were all wondering. So Nancy actually created a deaccessioning policy, which has not yet been used, but it's there. Now, the next step after accessioning will be processing, so there needed to be a way to move on to that. The Highlander Center, like many archives, does not have unlimited money or staff, so Nancy decided, and I agree, that the best way to prioritize the collection would be to do a quick and dirty look at preservation while accessioning. While the archives itself is a stable environment, 65 degrees, there it is, with its own dedicated humidifier, the issues involved many of the collections being housed in non-acid-free folders with metal fasteners, and that's not counting the film, audio materials, and photographs, and all of the issues that come along with that. We included this information that we recorded on the accession form, so when the time comes to process, there will be a record of where to start. Now, Nancy will talk more in detail about that.
Okay. All right, so as Laura has shown, the Highlander Center lacked a collection development policy and accessioning process and a system to prioritize any kind of processing. At minimum, the Highlander Archive lacked records of the various collections that continue to pass through the doors, let alone collections permanently housed at the center. So it was necessary to establish a standardized system of accessioning that integrates the records of both permanent and impermanent collections into one single system. This system needed to establish intellectual control and begin the process of managing the data. And in order to do so, as Laura said, I created a customized accession and deaccession forms based on the examples in the SAA book. That is titled Sample Forms in Archival and Records Management. This accessions data is saved in an Excel database and also in hard copy. The hard copy filing system provides a backup just in case the database becomes corrupt or the FBI comes back to town. So. Okay. So basically, we have all of the elements of a basic accessions form, the collection name, material description, size of a collection, provenance, et cetera. And as Laura said, the two keys to resolving these two issues of maintaining an inventory and prioritizing processing are the accessions number and the preservation information. Okay, first the accessions number. All right, so the accession number needed to reflect this quagmire and gain some control over it. So the number is formulated as follows: the current year, the collection number, and then a location code for the permanent repository. So in our example here, the current year was 2008. That's the collection number, 233. And WI means that it will more than likely be sent to the Wisconsin Historical Society. Okay. By the way, that is a picture of the archives. It is inside of that hill that the library runs into, so we call it the Hobbit Archives because it needs to have a little round door, and, you know, they're thinking about putting a gnome statue on top of it, but anyway. Okay, so on to the database that pulls everything together. So all of the accessions information was input into an Excel database using rudimentary descriptors. So all this means is that for our purposes is that, like, simple descriptors were used to describe corresponding accession form elements and column headings in the database using field titles like needs to be flattened. Again, these simple descriptors are column titles with simple yes or no fields. So the spreadsheet can be quickly resorted by by preservation needs, and this will help you determine what steps are needed to prevent further damage from occurring and to find the most vulnerable collections in the archives. This is particularly useful in a nonprofit like Highlander, which has limited funding and therefore limited materials to process collections, because they'll get like a grant for $1,000 and just go and buy boxes. Because you can also resort this database to see what type of materials will be needed or supplies will be needed to process a collection and approximately how many, and then gauge whether an adequate supply of materials is on hand. Actually, I'll show you this little screenshot. Okay. And finally, resorting the data by location code compiles a list of collections by their permanent location. And this will streamline the process of pulling, deaccessioning, and processing collections for shipment or transfer to other facilities. And in the wonky case of Highlander, this gives us a way to separate the permanent collections from those pending withdrawal. Okay, because Highlander relies on volunteer efforts, one of the many things that were left behind were the accessions form, deaccessioning form, establishing a filing system, a paper trail, and how to label the boxes. So we left behind pretty extensive instructions on how to do that, and hopefully these will be the genesis for a procedures manual. Also left behind, this is the processing manual we hope to leave behind. Okay, there we go. Recommendations. We also left behind some extensive, let me back up. We also recommended that they establish collection development policies, processing standards, that they start to investigate a cataloging program for some of their, because they do have circulating collections of library materials there, that they gain more contacts at UT and at East Tennessee State University, continue with staff training, look into archivist toolkit, discussed code encoding finding aids, and that they actually gave them a copy of the SAA guidelines for photographic materials. This is a picture taken from Labor Day last year. Okay, so moving forward, I compiled a list of graduate study independent study opportunities. Laura was instrumental in coordinating the SIS School of Information Science cohorts tour. And we had the school director, some faculty, and 10 students attended workshops with Guy and Candy and had a tour of the center grounds, lunch, intro to archives, and we gave them copies of that graduate student independent study list. And on a really positive note, the Highlander librarian who you saw in the picture of her being run over by Pontiac, which she did of her own volition, by the way. And she knew that was going to be included. She has a great sense of humor. The Highlander librarian continues to attend workshops on preservation and archival basics at ETSU and is currently pursuing her master's of information sciences at UT. Elizabeth Dunham, who is on the UT library staff, is also working with Highlander they are using this Excel database to publish archival information and integrating it into Archon. So that's it. Thank you.
There's still candy. Oh, that's right. Enjoy the candy. Anyone has a question?
So we're going to have the speakers come up here so they can talk into the microphones and be recorded. So if anyone has any questions, please raise your hand, and I'm going to try to summarize your question so that it's, you know, picked up at the recording, so on and so forth. Yes, sir. So let me try to summarize that. You want to know about specifics of the FBI raid? Is that? Okay, so the more about the FBI raid and then getting the records back after the cases have been resolved.
That's a great question. In 1961, when the state of Tennessee put a lock on the doors of Highlander, they also, basically, it was a big corrupt scam by the sheriff. I mean, he made a lot of money off of the sale of the buildings and land. But they would not allow anyone associated with Highlander to buy back any of the materials, land, building, or anything. So apparently some students broke in to where they were keeping all of the library books. I would say they were holding them captive and stole them all back. So they have this original core collection of labor movement books at the in the Highlander archives now. But in terms of any archival collections, I'm not sure. If you want to give me your information, I can get back to you and let you know about that.
I'd just like to say that we don't advocate stealing and breaking into federal repositories in order to get materials. Let your students do that, I guess, is probably what Highlander would recommend. I'm just kidding.
Okay, yes.
I'm interested in asking Yale if she personally knows kind of, if she could some detail, what kind of...
Yeah, it's a good question, you know, when you have collections over such broad areas.
The question?
Oh, sure,
sorry.
Absolutely.
So it's a question about more information about the how researchers find out about the non-labor collections.
Yeah, it's really been a kind of expanding process, and it's interesting. Initially, it was really stimulated by the fact that we had so much better description on our website, and not just on our website, but findable through Google. I mean, that's really key. In terms of the Jewish collections, because the collection was so big and so rich and attracted a good deal of grant money early on, the collections were very well publicized. We spoke at all the major archival organizations, including SAA, about them. We went to Jewish groups. We spoke everywhere, synagogues, clubs, the Workman Circle, you name it. We did a couple little articles in Jewish publications. We eventually made a short film about the collection. I mean, the collection was so rich that it was obviously a good investment. Others have been publicized in different ways. We have a very active theater archivist right now who's a former business agent for Actors Equity, who knows a lot of people in the theater field, who's brought them in. We've really reached out to professors in a way that we didn't used to do in the old days, really getting out of the library and going to their departments and trying to... I mean, people don't really read websites. They have a tendency to look at them when they're already interested for some reason, unless they stumble on something through Google. And those are the sort of researchers who are working on a biography of some obscure individual or something, and they stumble across us, and they didn't expect to find a labor collection. But I think we really have multiple ways of publicizing the collections now. But as I also suggested, it's a huge drain on staff time. I mean, if our resources don't expand, we're simply not going to be able to do as much of this kind of thing as we have in the past, even.
Anyone else have a question? Yes.
I want to know for the Highlander people, what's the basis for, what basis are you using for what you're keeping and what you're going to send to other places? And how many is Tennessee State? I'm sort of interested in what context.
So that question was about the Highlander Center and how they make decisions about what is sent. out from the Highlander Center and what is kept?
I hit on it a little bit. It really is a lot of the collections that have been sent elsewhere are things that have already been done on their own. People who've been related to the Highlander Center who have already sent their materials somewhere else, we just kind of follow along with that. The whole, like, the ethics guidelines of not separating a collection is pretty much what's been followed. Other than that, nothing is really written down. A lot of times when we were as students working on this project, it was really just, hey, we found this. Susan, where does this go? So she actually, when she finishes her master, while she's finishing her master's, she's going to be working on writing it down because she doesn't want to get hit by a Pontiac and lose all of that information. But, yeah, it really is just following along with where other things have ended up. I mean, other collections, I think one of the collections had already started collecting something related to one of the Highlander collections, and when we found out, materials just started being sent there. But I would recommend contacting the Susan Williams. She's the one who's really actively working on that.
All right. Yes. Yeah, you in the back.
Hi, Sue.
Hi. I was wondering about...
So it's a two-part question. The first part is about changing research interests and how does our researchers involved in that with the finding aids. Is that kind of...
Well, I have to say, in some ways, the Archivist Toolkit has been a boon in this. We've been revisiting our old finding aids pretty regularly. We can't do it as much as we would like, but we do. But when a few years ago we started using the Archivist Toolkit and all our old finding aids that were already online and some others that were on paper were ingested there, we kind of looked over everything before we published it to a certain extent. And I'm not going to comment on the process of creation of finding aids in the toolkit for good reason, but updating is one of its beautiful strengths. Updating is so simple. Within our institution, we never had the ability to edit finding aids and have them be posted instantaneously with those changes. And we've been taking full advantage of that. It's really fun. And our researchers help us with that, too, as they correct and expand the information in our finding aids. We always hoped they wouldn't tell us those things in the past. Now we're like, great, that data is wrong. Good, fine, we'll change it, you know. And our vocabulary has changed, no question. We're trying to come up with descriptive terms that speak to some of these expanded interests and so on. And we are driven by input from researchers.
Is there a next question? Yes.
It's the Internet Archive. It's part of that big consortial project. We definitely would not be able to do it in-house. And down, I'm not doing that project, so I'm a little hesitant to comment on it in detail. But I know that down the road, the whole issue of storage of all this material is going to be huge, and we're really seriously hoping that it's all going to be stored at the national level as well. There's no way that our individual institutions are going to host the harvest of these websites. We're only doing 500 now. There are potentially so many more that we could be doing. You know, that's 500 to cover labor and politics. No, it's not enough. And so hopefully it'll continue to be a nationally driven and supported project.
Yes.
That's a great.
So it has to do with guidelines that Tracy uses, and when materials come in, the decisions made based on what you said you did and did not want.
The guidelines for that actually says we may not accept loose papers, and that one example that I gave is a really great find, but most of the time when we do have a box full of loose papers, it's old newspapers, it's, you know, not stuff, it's stuff we've seen in other places, it's like an extra stack of contracts that were on the table, things like that. So I think, because right after I sat down, Gail leaned over and said, you know, that's it, you know, keep your guidelines. I'm much more comfortable saying probably not than no. And there's also a caveat in there, and this is something that we left when the Ruther donated, that or not donated, but let us borrow extensively their great guide, that it says, if you feel like anything you have, you know, give us a call. We'll talk about what you've got. So there are ways there for people to defend what they're going to send to us. And again, people are going to, like I said, they're going to do that anyway. We'd like to think that they're going to be responsible and folder it, or at least put some level of description on it. But they don't. I'd rather have it and say no to it than to not get it and it be great. So.
So this is about the Highlander Center. The question is, have you contacted the repositories where you're sending materials and try to coordinate something between everyone?
Not at this time, because that was my question too. Like, why don't we just bring everything back in one place? But as you saw, the Hobbit Hole is actually not that large. It is very cramped, and there are larger collections. I mean, there's nothing that's just a box or two. Maybe in the future, if we get lots and lots of money.
Yes.
Tracy, how often do you acquire records from a vehicle organization? Is it every year, every 3 years, 5 years?
It's not regular. People who donated in the early days when the archives were started and they were out really hitting the streets, so much stuff came in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And then we haven't heard from them. And then they'll call and say, well, 20 years ago we donated something to you, and we've got 20 more years of stuff for you now. So there's not a regular – and to my understanding, there was never one established. And in the last 3 years, just sort of given the other – like learning the collection and working with donors and getting to know my donors, that, like, getting folks on a regular schedule. You brought it up today. That's the first time I've actually considered it. I mean, it would be great. It would be helpful, and it would be in a perfect world. But with the turnover of officers, sometimes I call folks, and they won't even know that we've got their stuff, that, you know, 50 linear feet of stuff was donated in the mid-70s. You know, what do you have? You really have that? That's, you know, that's great. And because sometimes, like, a issue about a deed of gift or something will come up, and then I, you know, is that union still in existence? Okay, if it is, what are they still around, and who's running it now? You know, the guy that had the, you know, has been president for the last 50 years, that is the exception. And so nothing regular has ever been started. And if it were, given the amount of turnover, I think it would be hard to maintain that.
Yeah, we have trouble also with those kinds of relationships. We rarely get things on any kind of regular thing, but we have found that the turnover of officers can sometimes work to our advantage. We try to keep an eye out because the next president sometimes is a little more sympathetic and the records are getting older and he doesn't care about them or she doesn't care about them anymore. On the other hand, the turnover of officers is really the bane of archives too, because that's when things often get thrown away, especially at locals. So it sort of cuts both ways. But we try to keep an eye on what's going on with our major donors so that if there's an opening for us, we can get in there and get those records that they denied us the first time around or whatever.
And it's not just officer turnover, but sometimes unions merge. Sometimes unions shut down. Sometimes they become completely different unions. So keeping up with the sort of genealogy of a particular union can be difficult as well.
All right. Back there.
I have a question.
Yeah. Well, I've actually been able... Always do that. Sorry, everybody.
The question was about Tracy and implementing an actual, I guess, records management program at the offices.
I do very rarely have the opportunity to go and talk to folks. So both the Georgia AFL-CIO and the South Carolina AFL-CIO have invited me to their annual meeting to do a session on keeping union records. And I use that great keeping union records book that, you know, as a guide. There's no need to reinvent the wheel. It's such a great book. I condense all the information into a handout, and I go and talk to them about the importance of controlling their own records in-house. And you get a lot of people who are like, very supportive of it in theory, but in practice they're just too overwhelmed. And especially when you've got a union and they've got 40 years worth of stuff in there, it freaks them out to think about having to go back through all of that and do it. So the information's there, and I have done that kind of outreach. Also, I have the occasion to, every couple of years, go work with the machinists at their Education and Technology Center up in Hollywood, Maryland, and part of the week-long, it's called the Local Lodge History Project, and part of that project is doing a class on helping them keep their records. And again, they it's not that they're not receptive to it, but it's not their priority, and that's the reality of it. So,
did you have... there's on the Wayne State University website, there's at the Reuther Library, there's the form or pamphlet, I guess, or what you...
Booklet?
Yeah, booklet that Tracy referred to earlier in her... It's on their website available that Tracy referred to in her presentation.
Yes.
So that question was for everyone about their use of documentation strategies.
I will say that that one thing that was very strongly emphasized to me whenever I'm at Highlander and I'm talking about the history of Highlander is that they are very, very active today in working with groups. And they have so many civil rights, immigrants' rights, gay rights groups coming to them wanting to use their facilities for workshops, for weekends, that I don't think that they have to seek out other groups necessarily to get, you know, more materials for their collections. It really, they all go, for the most part, to them. So,
I think we have, in recent years, done this to some extent in some of our special projects, like the one to document the Asian American community that was stimulated by a grant from the state. We've seen some yawning gaps in our collections and tried hard to fill them. The building trades was another area. They were not giving stuff to us. We had to really go out there and work and survey and develop strategies to get anything in on the building trades at all. But it's an uphill struggle, and sometimes we've asked ourselves, let's not get too elaborate with our strategies because we're going to get what we're going to get. As Lucinda, who asked the question, knows only too well, she was the archivist of the United Federation of Teachers and tried to get them to do records management for forever, and really it's a result of many of her efforts that the UFT collection is as good as it is. So, you know, what can you say? It's a tough struggle with unions, and they have other problems. But we do try. We really do. And that's what brought us into the Asian American community, because we realized that going around from union to union was not going to be the way to document the working experience of Asians in New York. No way.
Since I've been there the 3 years, I have work to learn the collection and figure out where the gaps are, but it really does seem like every time I think, you know, I've got something in and I can start looking around to see really where the gaps are and who I need to contact, somebody's on the phone calling me saying they've talked to somebody at the union I was at last week or over at the AFL-CIO. So because they're keeping me busy that way, and given my other responsibilities, I haven't had as much of an opportunity. And we do have largely traditional labor union records. But recently my department's been talking about immigrant labor in the Southeast and maybe looking at in the next few years, even if we're only getting records from the organizations that are helping these people, it'll be a way to fill in that gap in the South, and it will be it will stray from our original, I guess, mission statement to get labor union movement work, you know, records of workers, but I think it's worth doing, and certainly working on the strategies will be something I'm doing in the next couple of years. So, thanks for asking.
Is there anyone else? Well, actually, I can ask a question, and it's going back to something else you're talking about you know, non-labor researchers coming in, and you know, I guess there is the Google part of it, but then I wonder if, you know, you've ever thought about doing like a, I don't know, a subject guide for what might interest someone who's not doing labor research, but, you know, like you're saying, urban history and that sort of thing. I mean, I wonder if, because, you know, I think there are some researchers who might say, well, labor unions, I'm not interested in any of that stuff. But then there's all these different subjects. So I wonder if you've ever thought about or have put together a, you know, something for that researcher.
Again, we've tried in our limited hours of work, but, you know, we do have a guide for women's resources because people ask about them, and we realized there was a need and a desire out there. We have one on Jewish-related collections. We could do a whole lot more, and we'd love to be able to. It's really a good idea.
One was done at our repository many years ago, probably in the early to mid-80s, and we're currently undergoing web redevelopment right now, and they finally realized that the Special Collections Department would need its own web redesign group because they thought they could just do with our pages what they did with the rest of the library's pages. And now that it's there, we're really looking at putting together that kind of guide, but including all of the collections. We have a women's collection. We have popular music. We have university records. We've got a small rare books collection, and we've recently started collecting in the area of social change in Atlanta. And we've also got a great photographs collection. So we're looking together as a department because most of our collections are 20th century. Most everything there was created after 1940, putting together a big one for our entire department. And probably to do that, we'll use existing materials, older materials that were created, mm-hmm. and then add to them from there.
So, are there any other questions? I think we've got about 5 minutes or something, but there's nothing else. I guess we'll wrap things up and give the speakers a big round of applause.